Hello, Ms. Davis. My name is Michelle Mbekiani. I am a second year at the law school. Thank you very much for coming here. To give my question some context, a lot of transgender women in New York City are arrested simply for having a condom, and condom is used as the evidence for soliciting prostitution. Given all the progress that we've made with the lesbian gay community, oftentimes we forget the T in LGBT. Can you speak on the relationship between granting or socially elevating a portion of a group and its relationship to this categorizing that you speak of and creating a margin within the margin?
Well, okay, I have a really succinct response to your question, because I think you eloquently laid out the issue with your question. And it was Dr. Martin Luther King who said that justice is indivisible, and injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And we should always rely on that principle. So thank you.
Hi, Angela James.
Hi.
My name is Indigo. I wanted to ask you, who is the movie that you made about you, did you make it?
Oh, thank you. You know, I'm glad you asked me that question, because I actually did not make the movie, and people keep saying, your movie. The documentary was made by a woman whose name is Shala Lynch, and there are a couple of things that I think that are really important. First of all, she did amazing archival research, and I don't know if you know what archival research is, but she looked for a lot of old film from 40 years ago, and found things that I had never seen before. So I learned a lot from seeing that film. But I think what was most important about the film was that it tells the story of a movement. It tells my story, part of my story as well. But what's most important to me is that it tells the story of a movement that was victorious, that won against the most insurmountable odds. Because even though I was innocent, I was up against some of the most repressive forces that we've ever witnessed in the entire history of the U.S. I'm talking about, and maybe you'll learn something later about Richard Nixon, he was the president, and Ronald Reagan was the governor of California, where the trial took place, and J. Edgar Hoover, whom you'll learn about as well, was the head of the FBI. And against that unholy triumvirate, nobody thought it was possible to win, but people came together all over the country. There were huge numbers of people in Chicago. And let me say thank you 40 years later to all of the Chicagoans who stood up in my defense. And people in Africa, in Asia, in all over Latin America, all over Europe, people everywhere. It was an amazing movement. And I was telling somebody that my Pilates instructor was... Yeah, I do Pilates. I do yoga, too. My Pilates instructor was telling me about her experience seeing the film. She went with a friend. So she said to the friend, is she going to get out? Is she going to get out? Is she going to... And the friend said, well, you see her twice a week, so you know she's out. But anyway, thank you so much for the question.
You're welcome.
Good evening. As a legal professional, I was wondering if you can provide me with a plan of action to help with prison reform.
Okay. Well, I may not be able to give you a plan of action, but first of all, I suggest that you develop some relationship to some progressive lawyers organization. And I think there's the National Conference of Black Lawyers, and there's the National Lawyers Guild. So I think that's the first thing. And then I would say, so how long have you been a lawyer? Oh, you're studying. Okay, you're in law school. Okay. Learn the law well. Learn it well. But also learn how not to take it so seriously that you let it control everything that you think. So learn also to be critical of everything you encounter. Because the law is one of those problems, particularly in the way that it makes what is ideological appear to be normal. And it seems to me that all of us have to learn how constantly to question and criticize that which appears to be most normal. Because in a lot of ways, that is the answer to so many questions that we would not even know how to ask if we did not engage in that kind of critical thinking, critical engagement with the law. But good luck. And work for justice. Work for real justice.
Welcome to Chicago, Ms. Davis. Thank you very much for coming. It's a lot of pressure figuring out the one question to ask your Shiro, but I think I've come up with it. I do a lot of work with young folks, mainly with this Freedom School we have here in Chicago. And my question would be, our Senator Mark Kirk announced today that he wants to spend tens of millions of dollars rounding up all between 18,000 and 100,000 gangster disciple gang members and treating them as terrorists. This is very frightening to me, but there's a lot of people who have begun to dehumanize gangbangers, and they don't see it as really a problem. What would be some suggestions to really get people to realize that these are people too, and we should care about this?
Yeah, you sound like You sound like you're such an intelligent and passionate. I can't really see you that well, though. Yeah, why is everybody so far in the back? Can't we move the mic up? Thank you. You seem like you're precisely the kind of person who can provide that leadership. And Chicago. And I mean, look, the applause you just got. So the question is, how to develop a movement that is going to shift opinion, about people who are perceived as threats to our security. And it used to be that we thought it was basically, white people. And now we know that it's not. So many people have been influenced by the criminalization process by the assumption that all young black and Latino men, like Trayvon Martin, right, are violent. And in many ways, that violence is connected to the violence of the state. You know, why are there gangbangers? Where do they learn that violence works? Or where do they learn that violence is represented as working? This society is so saturated with violence, and why target those who are least likely to be responsible for the production of violence in the society? So that's something that we really have to work on, and it's related very much to the whole idea that decarceration is possible and that abolition of the prison industrial complex is also possible. Good luck with your struggles.
Good evening. I have truly enjoyed you this evening. And you hit on so many subjects that have to do with the depression and the trauma that we as people of African descent are suffering from. And so as I think about it, I say, I know the perfect person who can help with the reparation movement, Angela Davis. So what I'm asking you is that I'm involved with an organization called NCOBRA, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparation. And we feel that there's a healing needed. And so much has been postponed and ignored. And so I'm hoping that you can help us in the movement and give us some advice on how we can push this movement forward, because it would be good for the whole country.
You're absolutely right. And the ghosts of slavery are still very much with us today, precisely because it has never been possible in the history of this country to come to grips with the damage that slavery did, and to learn how to recognize the extent to which the racism linked to slavery is still very much a part of our lives. Now, reparation. Let me just get some tea. I'm standing down here because I can't hear. There's a lot of echoes, and the speakers, I think, are in front of me. So I can't hear the questions very well when I stand up at the podium. But I've always thought that it would really be wonderful to create some alliances with other communities that are also demanding reparation. You know, what about reparation for the initial genocidal colonization of this country? And also develop links with the Japanese American reparation movement. See, I think what we need to be about, and this was one of the reasons I decided to, you know, focus my presentation on trans prisoners, because we have to learn how to expand our sense of community. We have to learn how to work across lines that are designed to separate us, to keep us from knowing each other, from struggling with each other, and from loving each other. And so that would be, I say, keep doing the work that you're doing. It's really important, but try to be as expansive as possible. Thank you.
Hi, Ms. Davis. My name is Anta Njai. I'm a 15-year-old sophomore at King College Prep, which is right up the street. I'm a very huge fan. I'm actually shaking right now. I feel like I'm
That's
about
okay.
to...
That's okay.
But one thing you discussed was norms and how some negative things in society have become norms. And one norm that Chicago knows too well is gun violence. My dear friend, and some other people in this room, my friend Kaylin Jones, who was in the balcony, our dear friend Hydea Pendleton, was gunned down at a park around the corner from our school. Now, we try to pass on this wake-up call that gun violence should not be a norm, but it's been accepted not only by our people, not only by people around us, but also by CPD. It's been considered a problem that they can't solve, that can't be solved. And I'm asking you, what can I do? Because me and my dear friend Kaylin, we try. We consider ourselves the black and conscience of our generation, and we try to wake up our peers, but the wake-up call isn't coming soon enough. And I'm asking you, the icon that you are, what can we do?
You see what I mean about the younger generation? But thank you so much for that question. And I think we should have a more extended conversation later, because it is complicated. And let me say that you may know that that I was charged with murder, kidnapping, and conspiracy because I was a gun owner in 1970, and I grew up in a family that had, my father had guns, and it was because they were deemed necessary at that time to protect ourselves from the Ku Klux Klan. And I know the only time those guns came out was when there was word that the Klan was in the neighborhood, or when we thought the Klan was planting bombs or something like that. And I just want to say that because sometimes people look at the Black Panther Party and the fact that the gun was a symbol of the Black Panther Party, and they think, oh, that's the same as all the guns that are in people's hands today. No, that is not true. The idea then was only self-defense. It was only about self-defense and defending. And it was about defending our right to struggle for freedom and equality and justice. Now, today, there are 300 million guns in the civilian population of the U.S. Nation. That is to say, there are almost as many guns as there are people. Now, that is crazy, isn't it? That is bizarre. I think that also has something to do with the fact that that the U.S. has the largest prison population in the world, the largest number of guns in the world, the largest prison population in the world, and I think it has something to do with the massive police violence that happens all over the country. Hydea Pendleton, your friend, and I can talk about Oscar Grant and Alan Bluford in Oakland, and I can talk about Kimani Gray, who was shot in the back in Brooklyn. Now, I think that in this era, we have to say no more guns. We have to talk about removing all guns from the hands of human beings. So, what does that mean? It also means we have to talk about disarming the police. If the police didn't have guns, then there would not be so many guns in the hands of people who, like the police, don't even know what to do with the guns. But I think this is going to be this is an abolitionist struggle, right? So we have to try to imagine a future in which it is not necessary for the police to bear arms. And at the same time, we continue to work towards disarmament. And let me just say, I was kind of upset when the whole debate around gun violence arose, especially in the aftermath of Sandy Hook Elementary School. And I didn't hear anyone mention Trayvon Martin's name. I didn't hear brought into that conversation ideas about how to end the racist assaults of police that are happening in Black communities and Latino communities all over this country. And that has to be at the center of the conversation. Thank you.
I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but we can only take two more questions.
Oh,
sorry.
God.
Yes, I know.
Thank you. Yes, good evening, Professor Davis. It is a great honor to be in your presence. And you mentioned earlier about youth and their willingness, no, their involvement in the movement and making change. I've spent a lot of years working with youth. I continue to work with them today. And the idea of throwing off decades of ideology of what is normal. Our young people, they seem to have an innate ability to do that. But my problem is, how do we help guide them with this new thinking and save them from being, caught up, not completing the necessary things in order for them to carry out their ideas? Like dropping out of school or things like that.
Yeah. That's a hard question. I mean, it seems like it might be a simple question, but it's really a hard question. I mean, it's a hard question because those of us who are older, we really want to share our wisdom and our experience and use that to guide young people, right? I mean, after all, we're the elders. But then on the other hand, most of us who've been involved in the movement for some years, if we remember what we were like when we were young, we have such short memories. As soon as we grow old, we forget what it was like to be young. And we start acting like we've been old for all of our lives. So, a part of it is sharing those experiences, yes. But not in such a way that prevents young people from trying out new things, from experimenting, from being imaginative, from taking risks, from doing things that we would think are absolutely mad. And I always, and I mentioned this yesterday when I was speaking at the Woodlawn School, that I know that there were many people back in the 60s who looked at Huey Newton and Bobby Seale when they said, they were going to go and patrol the Black community in Oakland. And how are they going to do that? How are they going to deal with the racist cops in the neighborhood? They were going to take guns and law books. They were going to have a gun in one hand and a law book in another hand. And the gun was going to basically symbolize resistance to the occupying police forces. And the laws were going, the law books were rather going to symbolize their efforts to inform people of their rights. This is like pre-Miranda, right? And I mean, I know they talked to some older people about it, and some of them said, boy, that's crazy. You're going to get yourself killed. But if they had listened to those who had the experience, they would not have, you know, just jumped out there and done this absolutely insane thing, and in the process created a movement that spoke to people all over this country and indeed all over the world, because there were Black Panther parties that emerged in New Zealand. There were Black Panther parties that emerged in Israel. There was a Black Panther party in Brazil. So I'm always thinking, okay, I think I have an answer to your question now. I think that as older people, we also express the willingness to learn. So it's not just that the older people have all of the knowledge or have the monopoly of knowledge, that we exchange, we develop an intergenerational knowledge that allows the young and the old to benefit from the knowledges and the experiences of the other. And I think that's the best way to go.
So quickly, you mentioned the liberation of asylums as related to the abolition of prisons. You mentioned...
It's just kind of hard to hear, so just talk a little more slowly. Okay. That's all. We have a little time.
Okay, so you mentioned the liberation of asylums as related to the abolition of prisons. Yes. Prisons are the site for the development of mental health issues. There's a misconception that people of color don't have mental health issues, but we do, and they get higher in prison. Mental health institutions can and have perpetuated violence as well. How can we validate the needs of people who are psychiatrically, intellectually, and developmentally disabled while resisting corporate hegemony in all institutions of violence?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, and you should have been at the colloquium today. It was great. Talk to Aliyat, who's sitting over there. Oh, there she is, right there. So talk to her. She can give you the long answer. And I can just give you a brief answer. One of the points that I was trying to make is that it's a feminist move to consider psychiatric institutions and prisons together. And I've always thought that if one really systematically examines the history of those two institutions, do something like Foucault did for the history of the prison, discipline and punish, but also add to it history of the asylum that, of course, it's already been done, but if you bring them together, you produce something entirely new. And we were talking today about the fact that there have been these gender disproportionalities. Far more men than women in prisons, but in the psychiatric institution, for a while, there was a majority of women. And I think Bernard Harcourt was just telling me today that it's about 50% male and female, so we don't see that disproportionality. But we see the way that both institutions work to control populations, undesirable populations, surplus populations. One of the points that was made at the colloquium today is that the three largest mental institutions in the country are Cook County Jail. Yeah, no, I know. I mean, I know the three. I was just wondering if anybody else did. I was wondering if you could answer that question. What are the three largest mental institutions in the country now? Yeah, I hear the largest is apparently Cook County Jail. And then there's LA County Jail. And then there's Rikers Island in New York. And that's because the prison is used to manage populations that have psychological issues, but also prisons create those problems. So yes, especially if you look at the Supermax. The Supermax is precisely designed to make people mad. So I guess I would say that that's a project that's really important. You know, talk to Leah and some of the other participants in the colloquium, and I think you'll get a really rich answer. And she is co-editing an anthology which should be coming out sometime. Can I say it? Okay, that is called Disability Incarcerated. So we get to look at the extent, not only get to look at the extent to which differently able communities have been profoundly affected by the prison system and the prison industrial complex, but we also get to reflect on what abolition would look like, you know, from the perspective of disabled or differently able communities. But thank you very much for that wonderful question, and thank you for your attention. And I love Chicago, absolutely. Thank you.